This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present Age of War by Michael J. Sullivan. Narrated by Tim Gerard Reynolds. Chapter 1. The Road to War. Life had been the same for hundreds of years. Then the war came, and nothing was ever the same again. The Book of Brynn. Suri the Mystic talked to trees, danced to the sound of wind chimes, hated bathing, howled at the moon, and had recently leveled a mountain, wiping out centuries of dwarven culture in an instant. She had done so mostly out of grief, but partly out of anger. A dwarf had been insensitive after the death of Suri's best friend. He should have been more sympathetic. But during the days since it happened, Suri had come to realize she could have shown more restraint. Perhaps merely setting Gronbach on fire, or having the earth swallow the vile wretch, would have been a better choice. Neither option had occurred to her at the time, and an entire civilization had suffered. It had been a bad day for everyone. Nearly a week later, Suri woke in a field amidst salathan, ragwort, and meadow thistle, the sun peeking over distant hills. Golden shafts made diamonds of dewdrops and revealed the labor of a thousand spiders who had cast nets between blades of grass. Having spent the night outside, Suri, too, was soaked and a bit chilled, but the sun's kiss promised to make everything better. She sat in the dew, the sun on her face, and stared at the field surrounding the seaside doll, listening to the faint hum of bumblebees as they began their morning's work. Then a butterfly flew across her sight and ruined everything. Suri began to cry. She didn't bow her head. Keeping her face to the sunlight, she let the tears roll down her cheeks, spilling onto the grass, adding to the dew. Her little body hitched and shuddered. Suri cried until she was out of tears, but the pain still tore at her heart. Eventually, she merely sat in the field, shoulders stooped, arms limp, fingers reaching out for the warm fur that wasn't there. Since returning from across the sea, most days started this way. Mornings offered a tiny respite from the pain, but before long she remembered, and reality crashed in. Then the sky became less blue, the sun not nearly as bright, and not even the flowers could make her smile. And there was one more loss left to face. Arion was dying. "Suri!" She was slow to react, slow to realize it was her name being called. Somewhere behind her, the grass rustled and feet thumped. The rapid tempo of those footfalls indicated it could only be one person, and that meant just one thing. "Suri!" Brynn called again. The mystic didn't bother to turn, didn't want to see, didn't want to face. "She's awake!" Brynn shouted this time. Suri spun. "Her eyes are open!" Brynn was running, plunging through the tall grass, soaking her skirt. Every muscle in Suri's body came alive. She sprang up like a startled deer and sprinted past Brynn, racing toward the road. In no time, she reached the tent Roan had built specifically for the Miralith. When Suri burst in, Arion was still on the pallet, but her eyelids fluttered. Padera was helping her sit up to drink.
"Tiny sips," the old woman barked. "I know you want to guzzle like a drunk, but trust me, it'll come right back up on you. And me. Even if you don't care, I do."
Suri stood under the flap, staring. Part of her refused to believe what she was seeing. She was afraid it was merely a dream, and worried that the moment she embraced the sight, the illusion would dissolve, and the pain would rush back with twice the force. She didn't know how many more blows she could survive.
"Come in, go out, pick one," Padera snapped.
The old woman, her lips sunken over toothless gums, squinted with her one good eye against the blinding sunlight. Suri took a step forward and let the flap fall. The lamp was out, but sunlight burned brightly through the cloth walls. Arion was resting against Padera's shoulder. The old woman helped the Frey hold a ceramic cup to her lips. Over its top, the Frey peered back with weary eyes. The old woman tipped the vessel, and the Frey slurped loudly.
"Okay, okay, that's enough for now," Padera said. "We'll let that settle a minute. If it stays down, if you don't erupt like a geyser, I'll give you more."
The cup came away, and Suri waited. Arion's voice. Suri needed to hear it to be sure, to make it real. The Frey tried to say something, but couldn't. She pointed apologetically at her throat. Suri panicked.
"What's wrong with her?"
"Nothing," Padera grumbled. "Well, nothing beyond sleeping for almost a week without food or water, which made her dry as the dust she nearly became."
Padera looked at the Frey with a small shake of her head and a confounded expression.
"With as little water as she's had, she ought to be dead. Any man, woman, child, rabbit, or sheep would have passed 3 days ago. Course, she's none of those, is she?"
Once more, sunlight pierced the room, blinding everyone. Rin stood in the entryway, holding the flap. She didn't say anything, just watched from the gap.
"Come in, go out, pick one!"
Suri and Padera barked in unison.
"Sorry."
Rin stepped in, letting the flap fall. All of them watched Arion. The Frey lifted her head slowly, focused on Suri, and smiled. Arion reached out a shaky hand. That was enough. Suri fell to her knees and discovered she still had tears left. She buried her face in the side of Arion's neck.
"I tried. I tried. I tried,"
Suri managed in between sobs.
"I didn't know what I was doing. I opened a door and found a dark river. I followed it toward a light, a wonderful and yet terrible light. I tried to pull you back, to fix you, but...
She felt Arion's hand patting her head. Suri looked up.
"Not tried."
Arion managed to croak with a voice as coarse as gravel. She then mouthed the word succeeded. Suri wiped her eyes and squinted.
"What?"
With more effort, the Frey said,
"You saved me."
Suri continued to stare.
"You sure?"
Arion smiled.
"Pretty sure."
Wraith refused to sit. Something about being seated in the face of such lunacy felt too much like acceptance. The rest of the clan chieftains, who referred to themselves collectively as the Keenig's Council, sat in the familiar circle inside Dol Tyre's courtyard. 4 chairs had been added, 3 to accommodate the chieftains of the Gula clans, and an elaborate seat with carved arms for Persephone. Gavin Killian, the prolific father of numerous sons, and the new chieftain of Clan Ren, sat in Persephone's old chair. Nephron wasn't seated either. He was up and speaking. Persephone nodded when the Galantian paused.
"She's not actually considering this, is she?"
Besides the 10 chieftains, most of the other usuals were there, except for Bryn, the Keenig's personal keeper of ways. Wraith had last seen her heading toward Padera's tent. the one they had Arion in. The Death House, some called it, since the Miralith hadn't shown any sign of life in nearly a week. The other non-chieftains in attendance included Moya, Persephone's ever-present shield with her famous bow, the dwarf named Frost, who always stood in for Rowan and reported on weaponry progress, Malcolm, who simply had a habit of showing up, and Nephron, who represented the Frey. That's how Wraith saw Nephron's role, as the voice of a small band of warriors. Given that Wraith represented only himself and Tesh, he couldn't begrudge the Galantian leader a place at the council.
At least I shouldn't. But I'm not making insane recommendations that will get everyone killed.
We must take Alan Reist, and we must do it immediately, Nephron repeated. He wasn't asking or suggesting. This wasn't a bit of advice or an option being presented. The Frey leader was demanding agreement.
Wraith usually refrained from talking in the meetings, and he felt Nephron should keep quiet too, for the very same reason. They represented virtually no one. But Wraith didn't like the look on Persephone's face. Her expression indicated she was weighing Nephron's words carefully. None of the other chieftains possessed the courage to challenge the Frey leader, so Wraith had to say something. Lack of proper weapons had been the reason he'd refused to be the Keenig in the first place, and Nephron wanted to take the risk before they had time to prepare. Persephone had returned from Belgrig with the Secret of Iron, but forging enough weapons for an army would take time.
"Your recklessness demonstrates why Persephone is the Keenig and you are not," Wraith said loudly to Nephron, drawing attention. "You're Frey. You don't care about the lives of us runes. The only thing you care about is winning. The amount of blood spilled while reaching your goal is inconsequential because it won't be yours. Attacking Alan Reist before we're properly trained and have adequate weapons will be suicide. Hundreds, maybe thousands, could die on those walls. And then
no one is going to die," Nephron replied in a superior tone that suggested he was speaking to an imbecile.
Wraith took a step toward him.
"If we attack one of the most fortified strongholds in the world with farmers armed merely with mattocks, men will die. Many men."
Wraith turned to the other chieftains.
"You've been to Alan Reist, right?" He pointed at Nephron. "Isn't it filled with an army of Frey warriors like him? Charging those walls will be like slapping a beehive with a stick, except these bees don't just sting. They cut off your head with very sharp bronze swords while hiding behind massive shields."
Persephone was paying attention to him, listening.
"That's something, at least."
"I'm not asking for anyone from here to fight."
Nephron spoke to Persephone, rather than to Wraith.
"Your people won't even have to get near the Reist. They will merely be decorative. A garnish, if you will."
Nephron began to pace back and forth.
"That fortress is my home. I own it. My father was the head of the Instaria tribe, the people who have lived in that fortress for centuries. He was the supreme commander of all the western outposts. That position typically falls to the son upon the father's death, which makes me Lord of the Reist. But the Fane, the leader of your people, put someone else in charge after your father challenged him. Correct?"
Tegan of Clan Warwick asked.
"Thank you, Tegan. At least one person is paying attention."
"True," Nephron replied. "But that Frey isn't well liked by my tribe, and the Instaria have been ill-treated for centuries, alienated and exiled through no fault of their own. They need a leader who understands their plight and can right their wrongs."
Nephron sighed.
"Do you think this is some impetuous idea that popped into my head this morning? I've worked on this plan for quite some time. I know how to take Alan Reist. And I can do so without the loss of a single life." "That's not possible," Wraith said. "We need to—"
Nephron rolled his eyes.
Allow me to explain why we must act immediately. I'll do so in short sentences with small words. Right now, the Thane is preparing his own forces. He'll need to marshal his troops on the frontier to attack us. The best soldiers are the Instaria tribe, my brethren, and they are headquartered at Alan Rist. The Instaria are the greatest warriors in the world. Without them, the Thane has no troops. I intend to steal his strength, but we have to move quickly. We can't allow Lothian to reach Alan Rist first. Nephron moved closer to Persephone. I can nullify the whole Instaria tribe from Irvanon to Meridid. Doing so will cut off the Thane's arms. He'll have no army to fight for him.
Will they fight for us?
Siegel asked. Nephron looked at the Gularoon chieftain as if he were a child.
Of course not. Frey don't kill Frey. But if you do as I say, I can ensure that they won't kill Runes either. And without his warrior tribe, the Thane will need to train others. That, he pointed at Wraith, still without looking at him, will give us time to forge weapons. Something we can do more effectively behind the Rist's walls. Nephron began counting off with his fingers. Alan Rist has tools, facilities, shelter, and food. Everything required to build the sort of fighting force needed to face the Thane's inevitable assault.
But how do we take it?
Tegan asked.
Just leave that to me.
See, that's where I have a problem. Wraith said. You expect us to trust you?
Nephron dragged a hand over his face in frustration.
It doesn't matter if you have doubts. The Runes will be perfectly safe. I don't want any of them within a quarter mile of the Rist. I and my Galantians will secure the fort. I only want you to be there.
You're certain the Runes won't have to fight? Persephone asked.
That's correct. I want you and your people to stand across the Burn River Gorge in the high plains of Dorea. Is that too much to ask?
Persephone looked at Wraith.
You can't listen to him, Wraith said.
This is foolishness. He can't take an entire fortress with a party of seven. Either he's delusional, or this is some kind of trap. At least wait until we have 1,000 swords and shields.
He turned to Frost. How long will that take? The dwarf puffed air through his beard and mustache, clearing the hair out of the way in order to speak.
We've selected 12 good men who are eager and capable of learning, but we're still struggling with the method and system. Although Roan carefully watched the swordsmiths produce an iron blade, she apparently missed a number of details. We are still working out the process, but we're getting there. Once we have the steps down, those 12 will take what they've learned and train a smith in every village in Rulin. And those smiths will take on apprentices, expanding our numbers. When the system is perfected and people are trained, the work won't take long. But getting all that going is the problem.
He rubbed his chin.
I estimate we could outfit a small army in a year.
There, Wraith said. And in that time, we can train the men to...
It will be too late by then,
Nephron said. The Thane will consolidate his hold on the frontier before winter. This is a race, and we've already delayed too long.
Besides, there is a fine smithy inside the fortress, and a few residents in the city have excellent forges and tools.
Also...
The Frey looked at Persephone.
Where will the people of Wren winter?
Here.
Will you shelter from the icy blasts against that wall?
He looked to Lippet.
Do you have room for them inside the city's walls?
Persephone's eyes darkened. Wraith was losing her. Losing her to him, which made it worse.
My way will ensure we can defend ourselves if things go wrong, Wraith declared. If he fails to deliver on his outlandish promises...
Nephron smiled as he cut Wraith off.
and my way will win this war.
Wraith glared at Nephron, but the Frey steadfastly refused to even glance his way. Nephron continued to study Persephone.
"How soon would you want to move on Ullan Rist?" she asked.
"Immediately," Nephron said. "We have already wasted too much time."
He gestured at the doll around him.
"While we sit and talk, who knows what the Fane is doing?"
"I'd feel better if we had some artistic support."
Persephone looked Wraith's way.
"In case anything goes wrong. But Arion can't be moved, and Suri won't leave her side."
"We don't need a mirror leaf to take Ullan Rist, and we can't afford to wait," Nephron said. "Arion is more likely to die than recover, and that mystic child is no artist. Waiting for Arion's death won't change a thing."
Bryn raced into the courtyard, and all heads turned. She was moving so fast, she had to skid to a stop. A huge smile stretched her cheeks.
"Arion's awake!"
They weren't an army. Far from it. The course of humanity had shifted in a very real sense. Suri was certain she'd seen rainstorms with fewer drops than the number of people walking north. And while Suri wasn't an expert on such matters, she imagined that even the worst army carried weapons, unlike the crowd around her. They were shepherds, farmers, leather workers, hunters, woodcutters, fishermen, brewers and traders. Most didn't own weapons. They carried bags and baskets. The rumpled host of that would-be army struggled to walk in line. They also complained about the pace, the road, and the sun, or its absence when the rain came. Most of the women had been left at home, except for those of Dal Ren, who didn't have a place to stay. Those without small children walked alongside their men, carrying bundles of food and clothes. The majority of the host was ahead of the wagon where Suri and Arion sat, all marching along the road that went by Dal Ren, the same path they'd travelled down seemingly a lifetime ago. Arion and Suri were tucked alongside barrels, sacks, pots, and wool, rocking and bouncing with the ruts and dips. The Frey had declared herself fit to travel, but she wasn't up for the long walk. Padera and Gifford, who served as cooks to that migratory march and also looked after Arion, rode with them. The two won seats on the wagon by virtue of Nephron's desire to travel quickly. Suri didn't make a habit of riding in the wagon, but she checked on Arion frequently, and sometimes napped among the sacks in the afternoon. No one questioned her right to do so. No one spoke to her much at all. Rumours had circulated about her incident in the land of the dwarfs. While Suri had always received stares as an outsider and a mystic, now the expressions of curiosity and disapproval were replaced by looks of fear. Folks sped up, slowed down, or even changed directions to keep their distance. With Persephone, Moya, Roan and the dwarfs also busy, the only ones who spoke with Suri were Padera, Gifford and Bryn. Everyone else acted as if she were poisonous.
"I've always liked being alone," she reminded herself. "I prefer it. Too many people in one place isn't natural. This is better."
But she wasn't alone. Suri was surrounded by people, yet not a part of them. She was the daisy among the daffodils, the fly in the goat's milk, the butterfly in the army. Suri turned and saw the trees off to their left, a slope running upward, leafy boughs nudging into darker, piney ridges. She knew that line, that rise of trees, that curve. Just beyond was a river, and over the next hill they would see the full face of the wood, the crescent forest.
"We're almost back," Suri said.
She checked the sun. "By midday, we'll be there."
"How do you feel?"
she asked Arion.
"We'll walk slowly. No need to rush."
Arion, who was sitting up and wrapped in a light shawl, appeared puzzled.
"Are we going somewhere different than everyone else?"
"Yes, to the Hawthorne Glen. Home."
"But Persephone... I thought we were headed to Ellen Rist."
Arion looked perplexed.
"That's where she's going. We're going home," Suri said. "You'll love it, Arion. The garden will be a disaster, but I'll take care of that. You won't have to do a thing except rest and get stronger. We'll go swimming."
"Suri, there's a war starting," Arion said.
Suri believed the Frey's voice reflected her health, and Arion's speech was still far too windy and hollow.
"Yes."
She glanced at the men with hoes and mattocks on their shoulders.
"And in the glen, we won't even know it. We'll be safe and happy. In a way, it'll be like old times, the way it was with Tura."
Persephone had wanted Suri and Arion to go to the Frey fortress, but Suri didn't think war sounded very pleasant. Instead, she had come up with a better plan. The two of them would ride on the wagon back to the Crescent Forest, then hop off and walk to the Hawthorne Glen. Arion was still weak, so they would go slow and stop often. Might take all day, but once there, Suri would show Arion the most beautiful place in the world. The little vale where the sunlight was more golden, the water sweeter, and where birds of different species sang in harmony. Suri knew Arion would love it, and in that wondrous place, the Frey would grow strong again. And then, Suri... Arion stared at her.
"Are you ready to talk?"
Suri looked away, focusing on the forest as home came into view over the rise.
"Are you going to tell me what happened?"
Arion asked.
"What do you mean?"
"Last thing I remember, we were trapped under a mountain. We had a deal, you and I. Since I'm here, I have to assume you didn't keep your end of the bargain. Don't you think it's time we talked about what happened?"
Hedera shifted uneasily.
"You should rest," the old woman said.
Arion ignored her and continued to focus on Suri. The Crescent Forest revealed itself in its formal gown of deep summer green. By contrast, the fields that skirted it were bright gold, with speckles of orange, yellow, and purple. Birds were swooping low, bees darting, and above it all, bright, white, puffy clouds drifted without a care.
"Aren't you going to tell me what happened to Mina?"
At the sound of the name, Suri tore her sight from the beautiful vision, but didn't look at the Frey or say a word.
"Suri, I'm not an idiot."
"I didn't say you were."
"Why, Suri? Why did you do it?"
Suri lowered her head, her lips bunching up in protest. She didn't want to have this conversation. Not now. Not with Arion. Not with anyone. Not ever.
"You loved her," Arion said.
"Still do."
The words escaped. A feeble, quivering hand touched Suri's wrist. Long, delicate Frey fingers, gently rubbing.
"I wanted you to kill me, not her."
"I know."
"Suri, I can't go home with you."
Suri pulled away, folded her hands in front of her, and looked back out at the forest. The vast expanse of green filled the view to the west. As Suri watched it roll past, she thought,
"It looks so strangely small. Has it always been that way?"
"You can't go either," Arion said. "You know that, right? You're a butterfly now, in more ways than I would have ever expected.
days of eating leaves are over. The flowers need you. Your home isn't in the Hawthorn Glen, Suri. It's in the sky. You can't hide. You need to fly. You need to show everyone the beauty of those wings.
Suri frowned and climbed off the slow-moving wagon. Right now, I think I'd rather walk. She let the wagon roll ahead. This left her at the rear of the long column. Quiet there, less hectic, and she enjoyed the feel of her feet on familiar, albeit sadly trampled, grass. Despite bringing up the tail end of the migration, Suri discovered she wasn't alone. Wraith trudged along in the soft ruts left by the wagon wheels. He had his limor folded and tied shorter and looser, in the way most men did that time of year. It exposed more of his hairy legs and arms. Furry was the thought that came to mind. He glanced her way, but didn't speak, and the two fell into a silent tandem march. They walked side by side in silence until they came to the intersection of the trail that led to Dal Ren. Suri didn't think she had come at it from this direction since the morning after Grin the Brown was killed. Both she and Wraith slowed. Both looked at the nondescript trail. Just a narrow path that wound through tall brown grass. Up that way stood the shattered remains of a wall, a lodge, and a well. The past that marked a turning point. Strange how deciding to walk one way rather than another can change your whole life. Wraith managed to put her own thoughts into words. I probably shouldn't have gone down that road. Part of Suri wholeheartedly agreed. If she had refrained from going to Dal Ren that spring, Mina would still be alive, and the two of them would be enjoying another summer together. Of course, if she hadn't gone, everyone else would likely be dead.
Do bad things happen if I don't know about them?
Suri sighed and wondered if Wraith had been speaking to her, or just talking to himself. She also wasn't entirely sure who she spoke to when she said, "The worst part is that I still can't tell if it was worth it." They looked at each other knowingly, then resumed following the wagons at a greater distance, lagging back, letting the world drift away.
I wish I were going home.
Suri kicked a loose stone into the tall grass.
I wish I weren't, Wraith said.
He glanced over.
I'm sure yours is much nicer.
He pointed at the wagon ahead of them.
How's Arion?
Annoying.
Suri expected him to show surprise and ask why. Instead, Wraith simply nodded, as if he understood everything.
I wanted her to come home with me to the forest, to the glen where I used to live. I figured we could be happy there, but she insists we have to be part of this war.
Sounds remarkably like Persephone.
Really?
Wraith nodded.
Won't listen to me. Listens to Nephron, though. She hears him just fine. We're going to war against the Frey, and whose counsel does she take?
So, you don't want to go to this wrist place, either?
I'd rather we were all in your glen.
He wiped sweat from his eyes, and peered up at the blazing sun, as if he and it were having a disagreement.
Can you swim there?
Suri smiled.
In a clear lake with swans.
Got food?
More than enough.
Sounds perfect.
It is,
she said, and meant it.
Over there, right?
He pointed at the cleft in the forest.
Yep, she replied. Up that slope, around to the left, and then over into the valley. We could arrive before nightfall, easy.
No one would even know we left.
The two looked at the wagons and the long column of men snaking to the north, which kicked up a cloud of dust. No one was looking back, but if they did, Suri and Wraith would be hidden by the cloud, they could slip away unseen and vanish into obscurity forever. The war would go on, but without them.
Two bad things happen if I don't know about them.
They both stopped, standing still in the middle of the road, listening to the sounds of the wagons fade.
"What do you think?"
Surrey asked. Wraith sighed, then shook his head.
"We can't leave them. And it seems stupid to start being smart now."
Surrey nodded.
"Yes, you're absolutely right. You must be the world's wisest..."
She caught herself, mortified.
Everything felt so familiar that the words just came out as they always used to, just as if she were walking with...
Surrey began to cry. She felt guilty, and hated herself for betraying Mina's memory so easily. He stood quietly, waiting beside her without judgment.
Surrey embraced him then. There was no thought in it. She needed to hug something, and he was there.
Surrey thought he might pull away, but he didn't. Instead, she felt his arms wrap around her, settling gently, holding her.
Wraith never said a word, and she knew that was exactly how it should be, between friends.
Chapter 2. Before the Bronze Gates. Alan Rist was just one of seven Frey fortresses that dominated our borders, but it was more than the seat of the Instaria tribe and the tomb of a long-dead fane. Alan Rist was the personification of Frey power and the absurdity of challenging it.
The Book of Bryn.
Wraith pulled Persephone up the last ledge. She could have climbed it on her own, and none of the chieftains had needed or been offered a hand, but she took his. Persephone felt it best to be agreeable when she had the luxury, knowing she couldn't always be so generous.
That's what she told herself. But she knew that if anyone else had made the gesture, she'd have waved them off.
Wraith was brave, capable, and handsome, wearing his lemur with a casual indifference. The young Dorian was a popular topic among the women, but he took no notice of their flirtations. What he wanted, she couldn't give. Persephone was still married to her dead husband, in ways she couldn't put into words or even thoughts. Emotions had a language of their own that didn't always translate.
Wraith and her husband were nothing alike.
Reglan, nearly 30 years her senior, had been more like a father, a teacher, a guide. With Wraith, she was the wise one, the steady hand that kept the rose straight. And yet, Wraith's hand felt good, safe, warm, strong.
She was the Kenig, chieftain of the 10 clans, supreme ruler of millions, but she still needed more. Power couldn't replace respect, devotion couldn't replace friendship, and nothing could replace the enveloping warmth of love. He did love her, wanted her, and while she couldn't grant his wish, at least not yet, she cherished the idea. The gift of his desire was another of those impossible-to-translate, difficult-to-corral feelings. Passion was a wild, selfish thing that didn't respect boundaries or common sense, but without it, life felt pointless.
"What did you call this?"
She looked around, getting a feel for the natural pillar of rock rising 60 feet above the plain.
"Misery Rock," Wraith replied. The sheer drop on all sides of that far-too-small-for-comfort pillar produced a flutter in her stomach.
She nodded.
"I can see that. Sure."
Persephone walked in a tight circle,
shuffling her feet, too scared to lift them. Falling was an irrational fear, as long as she didn't do anything crazy. The rock was as flat as a table, but she didn't trust herself. Stumbling is not an option, unless flying is, too. Persephone had never been one for heights. As a child, she stopped climbing trees at a young age, and escaped roof-thatching duties by claiming illnesses that were greatly exaggerated. Standing on Misery Rock, looking down and seeing the tops of all those walnut-sized heads that made up the Rulin clans, she felt dizzy. How did I ever find the courage to jump off that waterfall in the Crescent Forest? That incident seemed decades ago, rather than just a few short months. Wolves, she recalled. Yes, a pack of wolves in pursuit provided the necessary incentive. Persephone watched in awe as Suri scampered up as if the summit were a foot off the ground. The young woman was beyond fearless. She appeared thoroughly bored. From where they stood, Persephone could see for miles. "Did you live round here?" Persephone asked Wraith. He pointed toward the northeast. Most of Dorea was a dusty plateau, one great rock interrupted by jagged stone formations like the one they stood on. Looking in the direction he indicated, she spotted a black mark on the consistently blonde plain. "That was my village, Clempton," Wraith said. 37 buildings, 40 families, and almost 200 people." He continued to stare without blinking, a hard, brutal look. She wondered what he was thinking, then imagined herself gazing on the ruins of Dal Ren. Persephone put a hand on his arm. Her touch broke his stare, and he offered her a forced smile. All the Rulin chieftains were with her on the summit, while the Gula leaders were with their men, strategically stationed among the dips and clefts of the Dorian Plain. Nephron had positioned them the night before, saying he knew the places where Alan Rist's watchtower was blind. Persephone had been forced to repeat his instructions. The Gula refused to take orders from the fray. A wild and vicious people, the Gula runes were little more than a pack of rabid animals. Great when you needed that sort of thing, maddening when you didn't. Persephone forced herself to inch closer to the edge, to get a better look at the world below. The northern boundary of the Yellow Plateau was a steep, jagged gorge that, from their vantage point, formed a curve resembling a frown. At the bottom of that canyon, the Burn River flowed, which historically marked the end of Rulin and the start of the Frey Lands. Somewhere beneath Misery Rock, a worn path, appearing little more than a chalk mark on that open plain, ran north from Dorea to the gorge. The vague line ended at a set of white stone stairs that climbed to a bridge. For miles, the only place to safely ford the river was that span that linked the Frey and human sides of the canyon like a single stitch in the gaping wound that was Grandford. On the other side was the city and fortress of Alan Rist, with its great dome and soaring watchtower, the whole of it protected by massive stone walls and a pair of impenetrable bronze gates. Persephone had crossed that bridge of sculptured stone every year while married to Reglan. Each time had terrified her. "We had been invited, but I was still scared."
"They're up the stairs," Tegan announced.
The chieftain of Clan Warwick looked like an overgrown dwarf with neat dark hair and a brushed beard. Possessed of a sarcastic wit, he had a sharp mind, and had become one of Persephone's closest advisers. Tegan pointed, and everyone on Misery Rock looked toward the Grandford Bridge.
"I can't believe you agreed to this."
Wraith was shaking his head while looking at the sky.
"Nephron knows what he's doing," Persephone said.
trying to sound more confident than she felt. Her hands were clenched tight. She forced them open and made a deliberate effort to relax her shoulders. "What if he's wrong? What if they kill him?" Wraith asked.
"My people aren't prepared for this," Harkon said. "Most of Clan Mellon are carrying farm tools. We can't fight."
"If that happens, we fall back. We already have a sizable lead," Persephone told them.
"And Nephron?" Harkon asked. "If things don't go well, will he retreat?" "I don't think Nephron or his Galantians understand that concept," Tegan said. "They always assume they'll win. Let's hope there's a good reason for that."
Persephone straightened up. She kept reminding herself to stand tall. Her mother had always complained about her bad posture.
"No one will respect the wife of a chieftain who hunches over like a troll."
Her mother could never have imagined that Persephone would be a chieftain, much less the Keenig. But Persephone guessed the advice was still valid.
"There's a first time for everything," Krugan said.
"Then pray this is not that time." True to his word, Nephron hadn't asked a single human to cross the bridge with him. Persephone's army was barely in sight of the fray, forming on the far side of the burn. The Gula were even farther away, more than a mile, having formed on the crest of the high plain. That was the way Nephron wanted it. Persephone hoped that his plan was designed to give them ample time to scatter if something went wrong. But Tegan was correct. Galantians didn't understand defeat. She agreed that the odds of Nephron anticipating failure were equal to his expecting a day without a sunrise. From the vantage point of Misery Rock, Persephone could see the Galantians approach Alan Rist. The little troop of Frey appeared like a line of 7 ants. They reached the bridge and, without hesitation, began to cross. Trying to see better, Persephone took a step forward, forgetting, if only for that instant, that she was standing near a deadly precipice. Wraith caught her by the arm, silently reminding her of the danger and his concern for her. She glanced at him, and Wraith let go, looking embarrassed. Harkon, the chief of Clan Mellon, shook his head in awe.
"Fearless. Crazy," muttered Krugan,
whose only interest beyond fine clothing was sleep, something the man did a great deal of, snoring far too loudly to hide the fact.
"Why isn't anyone stopping them?"
Lippert asked.
"Same reason you wait when catching rabbits," Wraith replied. "Better to be sure you have them fully in the snare before pulling it closed."
Persephone's hands resumed their fists, and much to the dismay of her dead mother, she was imitating a troll again.
"What's that?" Krugan pointed. "Do you see it?" Harkon asked. "On the plain. On our side."
"More Frey," Wraith said.
Persephone saw them as well. 2 dozen bronze-armored warriors had appeared out of nowhere, cutting off Nephron's retreat.
"Where'd they come from?" Tegan asked.
"Cracks," Wraith explained. "The rocks out there are split with fissures and fractures. You can get into them, cover yourself in a dirt-colored blanket, and an enemy will walk right by. We did it all the time."
"Shouldn't Nephron know about that?" Krugan asked.
"And there you have it. Not as smart as he thinks,"
Wraith concluded, with a morbid, self-righteous tone. Persephone knew he was directing his frustration at Nephron, but she felt it spilling on her. After all, she had been the one who had sanctioned this action. The callousness of his cold judgment stung because he'd been right, and she hadn't listened.
"Do you think they planned for this?"
Alward of the Nadak pleaded, as if those gathered on that rock could grant wishes.
"The Galantians,"
Tegan said with an incredulous expression,
"they don't plan for anything. Forethought ruins the adventure, I'm told."
Alward frowned, his mouth still partially open, his shoulders slumping. Persephone took another step forward. Once more, Wraith grabbed her arm. The first time had been bad enough. Twice was uncalled for. Persephone was about to chide him, but then she looked down and saw she was less than a foot from the edge. Sucking in a short breath, she drew back.
"Can't afford to lose both you and the Galantians in one afternoon," Wraith said.
"Lose them?" The idea, so impossible, coalesced for the first time. "What if they are killed or taken? What happens to them? What happens to us?" Persephone looked down at the hundreds of her people nearby, and out beyond them at the thousands. She turned to reassure herself that Suri was still with them. The girl had leveled a mountain, so she ought to be able to protect them from a few hundred Frey. That was why she was on the rock, why Persephone had insisted she come. But Persephone had no real clue how magic worked, what Suri was really able to do, and the mystic had embraced Arion's distaste for killing. A good thing, Persephone often told herself, but just then she wasn't so certain. Persephone looked at the black patch on the plain, the village that had once housed 40 families, and wondered if she had made her first and last mistake as the Kenig of the 10 clans. Clutching the rolled-up flag in his right hand, Nephron led his Galantians across the Granford Bridge toward the Bronze Gates. 40 feet above the entrance, the crossed spear's symbol of one-time Thane Alan Rist frowned down. It would have been damn hard to erase, but the fact that Petrogar hadn't tried illustrated the difference between the current ruler of the Rist and himself. One of the differences. Only Feral knew how long that particular list might be if anyone thought to sit and compare. Nephron imagined that he and Petrogar didn't even chew food the same way. If the situation were reversed, Nephron's own symbol would have replaced the mark of Rist. Nephron didn't have a symbol yet, but he would soon. A dragon, or perhaps a lion. Something fierce, something powerful, something worthy. All great leaders needed to leave their mark on the world, and he would have already chiseled his on that wall.
"You shouldn't have come back,"
Sikar said, standing first and foremost among a brace of shields at the far end of the bridge. He wore full armor, as if he expected trouble. He also wore the red-plumed crest on his helm, an indication that the spear commander had risen in rank since the Galantian's banishment.
"Couldn't stay away."
Tekchin threw out his arms and puckered kisses at Sikar.
"We missed you too much."
Sikar frowned and shook his head. The captain of the Rist wasn't in a joking mood.
"You're an idiot, Tekchin."
His gaze moved to Grigor and paused briefly on the wooden box the giant carried. Then it shifted to the flag in Nephron's hand.
"Surrender or truce flag?"
Elisan, an older Frey who had been a close friend and advisor to Nephron's father, stood on Sikar's right and answered first.
"Truce. When have you known the Galantians to surrender?"
Sikar kept his eyes on Nephron.
"You know, it's customary to wave that before approaching. Not that it would do any good. The Thane has declared you exiles, no longer protected by Feral's law."
There was a terrible gravity in his tone, and enough remorse in his eyes for Nephron to make a mental note. Tekchin chuckled as he folded his arms across his chest. Nephron had given orders that no one was to touch weapons, and Tekchin was likely going through withdrawal.
"So, this is your big chance to rid yourself of those gambling debts you owe me, isn't it?" "This isn't a joke," Sikar shouted. "They're going to—"
Overhead, horns blared, and the gates opened.
Quiet, Tek Chin said. Your boss is coming.
Don't worry, I won't tell him anything. Sikar didn't look irritated. He looked sad. He slowly shook his head as he sighed.
Relax, Sikar, Nefron told him. I'm back now. I'll make everything right again.
They're going to execute you. You understand that, right? Nefron only smiled. Out of the gate poured a cohort of Instaria warriors. Nefron didn't need to look behind him to know that more would be blocking their retreat. He guessed Petrigar had turned out the entire first spear to welcome them. The show of force was more than a compliment, more even than evidence of Petrigar's cowardice. It was exactly what Nefron needed. The warriors fanned out in precision to either side of the bridge, filling the landing before the gates and denying them entrance. Nefron didn't have any intention of taking another step. He had planned this meeting down to the block of stone he stood on and, more importantly, the landing where the Instaria had gathered. After centuries, Nefron knew every blind spot and vantage point. Petrigar was the last one out. A brave one he is. At his side waddled Vertimus, legate to the fane. A portly Gwydri, he'd somehow managed to rise in station, or fall out of favour, in order to earn his post in the wilderness of Avalon. Vertimus had accompanied Petrigar when the latter arrived to replace Nefron's dead father as Lord of the Rist. All Nefron knew about the man was his complicity in the plan to send Rapnagar and the other giants to destroy Dal Ren and kill Nefron, Arion, and Wraith. The boy and his weasel make quite the pair.
"Nefron, son of Zephyron," Vertimus began. "You have been—"
"Shut up!" Nefron ordered. "I didn't come all this way to speak to you."
Petrigar's eyes widened.
"You have no—"
"Didn't come to talk to you either, you son of the Tetlin witch."
Petrigar looked confused by the runic insult, the tone of Nefron's voice, and, well, everything. That was just the sort of fray he was. While he looked to the others for understanding, Nefron took in the gathered faces of his family. He knew them all. Nefron's father was a tyrant when it came to his son. Zephyron, Lord of Alan Rist and supreme commander of all the western outposts, granted Nefron no privileges or special treatment. His son was forced to sleep in the barracks with the other Instaria. Nefron was also made to take his meals in the communal dining hall. Zephyron's son marched in the same mud and fought and bled alongside the lowliest soldier. At the time, Nefron had protested, but now, while standing on the Granford Bridge, he mentally thanked his father. This was just the second time he'd done that. The first was when Zephyron had gotten himself killed during the Uli Vermaar.
"I've come home to speak to my brothers."
The moment he said this, Grigor set the box down, and Nefron stepped up.
"Instaria!" he shouted from his elevated position, wielding the still-rolled flag as a baton, conducting a symphony of eyes. "The Lord of Alan Rist has returned. I come as a liberator to free the Instaria from the tyranny of morons and cowards."
"How dare you!"
Petrigar nearly screamed, his voice a perfectly discrediting screech.
"You are a—"
"For too long we have suffered the indignities and humiliation of a fane who does not respect us, who does not appreciate us, who does not love us."
Nefron had no trouble drowning out Petrigar's squeals. The Galantian leader had a good voice for speaking. Loud, deep, confident.
"You are a traitor!"
Petrigar shouted.
"And the son of a traitor!"
Without looking at him, Nefron chose to respond to the accusation, mostly because it dovetailed neatly with his speech. He hadn't expected help. Certainly not from Petrogar. But Nephron wasn't above accepting it when offered.
"My father gave his life for his tribe."